Hi, this is Barry Listed Informs, the Institute for Operations Research and the Management Sciences. You're listening to Science It Better, a series of podcasts about ways that analytics and math modeling help people like you and organizations like your own. We live in a complex society, and that complexity makes us vulnerable in new ways. In today's segment, we talk to Professor David Alderson of the Naval Postgraduate School and its Center for Infrastructure Defense, or CID. Professor Alderson's work on network science has a direct connection to the ways that we protect America's infrastructure from both terrorists and potential state enemies. Professor, welcome to the Science of Better.
Thanks, Barry. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we can go into any lengthy discussion, I think we need to provide a layman's explanation of two terms we'll be discussing. Could you explain what you mean by both network science, number one, and graph theory, number two?
Sure, Barry. So let me address the second one first. So graph theory is a branch of applied mathematics that has been devoted to the study of graphs. Now, a graph is a mathematical object. It's the collection of pairwise relationships between objects. In a graph, the objects are typically called vertices or sometimes nodes, and the relationships are referred to as edges or links or arcs. And the study of graphs goes back many centuries to a famous mathematician, Leonard Euler, and it's been used in the study of a number of different kinds of problems in mathematics, computer science, operations research, particularly those related to networks. So network science, and here I need to provide just a little bit of background in that while graph theory goes back several centuries, what we now call network science is really only about a decade old. In the 1990s, we started collecting much more information via all the new advances in information technology. And we started getting massive data sets on everything related to the internet, to biology, the Human Genome Project, to economic and social systems, things such as Twitter and Facebook and so on. In general, the size of these data sets are so big that it's hard even to visualize them in a sensible way. And this created a drive to develop new techniques to try to understand, discover key structure in the data with the hope that a deeper understanding of it would allow us to predict and perhaps even control the way these systems behave. Now, about a decade ago, there was a sort of a big change in the way that many scientists started thinking about the structure of these systems. In general, folks recognized that a lot of these systems could be understood as networks. And in fact, many scientists argued that the most salient features of these systems really resulted as a consequence of their underlying network structure. Based on this argument, folks essentially said that we need to study networks in a very new and fundamental way, and this led to literally thousands of publications, ranging from academic journal articles to popular science books. And collectively, this effort has become what we now think of and know as network science.
Okay, that's the background. To get into a couple issues that touch on network science and your work, in the year 2000, the journal Nature published a study about the way that network science and graph theory related to the vulnerability of the Internet, a topic that's very much in the news nowadays. Tell us about the study.
So this was a study that was performed by researchers at the University of Notre Dame. And in collecting data on the Internet, they discovered something that they didn't expect in the connectivity patterns that they observed. Now, here they were looking at several different kinds of Internet connectivity, including the connectivity of web pages, that is essentially how one web page links to another, as well as the connectivity of the underlying hardware, equipment that we call routers, which are responsible for the movement of packets of data across the network. What these researchers found was a skewed connectivity pattern in which most of the nodes had relatively few connections, but a select few of them, which they termed hubs, had many, many more connections. And essentially what they argued was that these hubs, if they were to be selectively targeted, could be the weak points in the network. That is, their loss would cause the network to fall apart, and in some sense, they represented what was termed an Achilles heel for the Internet. So the router-level Internet was claimed to have this vulnerability, And it was surprising because we think of the internet as a fairly robust system, and this got it considerable attention in the media and even made its way onto CNN.
And do you agree?
I don't. This particular claim of vulnerability is not true for a couple reasons that I'll try to summarize succinctly. The authors built a model that generated a synthetic networks that would match the connectivity statistics of what they had seen in the real system. The claims of vulnerability were true for their synthetic models, but their synthetic networks were not a good representation of the real internet.
I see.
So that is, although the connectivity statistics match the data, the model was really inconsistent with the underlying engineering and economics of the real system. And this essentially happened because they were focusing solely on the graph, that is the connectivity, and didn't see that if it were to be built, this network actually couldn't work in the real world.
And am I correct that you have a second beef with that article?
Yes. The second problem with it was that in retrospect, we now know that some of the underlying data that had been used to collect statistics really wasn't of very good quality.
So the data was a garbage in, garbage out kind of thing, or poorly collected?
Well, yes. It turns out that on the internet, although you know we like to think that we have complete control, what we think we're measuring is often not what we're actually measuring. And there's an entire discipline devoted to the study of internet measurement within the computer science community. It turns out that measurement is really quite tricky and has to be done very carefully. And in this particular case, the data that was observed was subject to both some errors as well as some biases in terms of what was there. So the bottom line was, yes, the data was not of sufficient quality to support the particular statistical claims.
Moving to a more recent study, there was a study in the journal Safety Science, and that led to a major scare in a similar vein. It was a hypothetical piece by a Chinese researcher in China about weaknesses in the American power grid. What did it say, and why did it raise such concerns?
Yes, so two academic researchers in China published a paper in which they claimed that attacks on particular nodes in an electric power grid could lead to a cascading failure. That is, the loss of parts of the system causes failures elsewhere, and this thing kind of rolls like a cascade. And as evidence for their claim, they performed numerical simulations on a synthetic model of connectivity data that was taken from the U.S. electric power grid. So this raised some considerable attention among folks in the U.S. government. It made its way actually in front of Congress. There was a U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Foreign Affairs that was meeting to discuss some of the issues that Google had recently had with issues on censorship in China, as well as more broadly on some of the problems or potential problems that cyberspace raises for national security. And this particular paper was brought up as evidence of some of the potential threats that our nation could face.
And once again, this is a red herring, if I understand your research correctly.
Well, yes. I mean, it's tricky again because we know that cascading failures can and do happen in the electric power grid. So it's possible that if you were to poke the system in just the right way, at the right time, you could initiate a cascading failure. And if it were true, it would deserve serious attention. But here again, we see some of the same features. The model was a synthetic model that focused primarily on connectivity. It did not reflect the engineering and economic details of the real system and didn't even reflect the physical principles on the way in which electricity flows through the network. So while the study was very interesting from sort of a pure scientific and mathematical perspective,
And also the fact that it was coming from China,
and also from the fact that it was coming from China, although, you know, these types of studies are done by researchers all over the world, but yes, absolutely, because it was coming from China, it got the attention of folks here in the United States.
Which brings us to what we really should be concerned about based on your research. You and a colleague at the Naval Postgraduate School, Professor Gerald Brown, have been studying America's infrastructure and its vulnerability at the school's Center for Infrastructure Defense, CID. What are you examining? Is it the internet? Is it the electric grid? Is it additional elements of our infrastructure?
Actually, it's a bit of all of them. So actually, Jerry and I are two members of a much larger team of researchers at our center who have been studying infrastructure for a long time. We study all sorts of things from energy systems to transportation systems to communication systems, supply chains, water systems. In fact, the Department of Homeland Security has identified a number of different critical sectors that they say are sort of crucial to the ongoing operation, and we have experience working on a large number of those.
For our listeners who are not trained in operations research in OR, can you explain a little bit about the modeling that you use?
Absolutely. So essentially what we're doing is we're using operations research. We're modeling the operation of some particular system, and we'll look at how systematic disruptions to those can affect the function of that. And we'll look at both the worst case kind of disruptions as well as how we can invest in order to make those systems resilient to those disruptions.
As I look at some of your writings, I see words like attacker models. What are the attacker models you build to provide insight to those who, say, want to look at the electric grid of this country or another country?
Yeah, so an attacker model is really an attempt to find vulnerabilities. And what it does is it represents the decision problem of an intelligent adversary who wants to deliberately inflict damage on a system or disrupt its operations. So again, these attackers are all hypothetical adversaries, and we use them to find vulnerabilities in a systematic way, typically with the intent of finding the most severe or worst-case vulnerabilities.
You've begun working with defensive modeling as well, and that brings us back to America's infrastructure. What do your models say about America's making America's grid safer?
Well, there are a number of things. What we're trying to do is represent a very important decision problem that we all face, which is how do we take the limited resources that we have and how do we invest them in a manner that makes these systems resilient both to non-deliberate hazards, such as natural disasters, accidents, and failures, to the deliberate types of threats, such as terrorism, sabotage, vandalism. In the end, this is a decision problem, and in operations research, we spend a lot of time and effort trying to formulate and solve decision problems in a manner that provides insight to real decision makers. So in the case of America's infrastructure, it really depends on the system under study, because the way in which the electric power system operates is different from transportation systems, is different from water systems or communication systems. There's no one-size-fits-all model that will do all of this. However, what we can do is, by carefully bringing in domain-specific details, pose it in a way that allows us to look systematically at where essentially we get the most bang for the buck.
One of the studies that came out of CID by your colleague Professor Brown and others was titled Defending Critical Infrastructure. It appeared in the Informs Journal Interfaces and suggested ways that optimization could be used to harden systems, if harden is the right word. Do you recall some of the examples given in that? I believe it dealt with strategic petroleum reserves, the U.S. Border Patrol, and an electric transmission system.
So let me comment briefly on the study done on the Strategic Petroleum Reserve in Louisiana, in part because we're all thinking these days about oil in the Gulf of Mexico.
Definitely.
So this study actually was originally conducted by a team of students as part of a course project. I should note that our military officer students here at the Naval Postgraduate School in the Operations Research Department learn how to do this type of attacker-defender modeling, and each of them does a case study on some type of infrastructure using sort of open-source information. And over the last 10 years, we've had over 150 of these different kind of student REN teaming projects done. This particular study on the Strategic Petroleum Reserve focused on the SPR, which is a storage and distribution system that is used in the event of an emergency. Now, like most pipeline systems that are designed for efficiency, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve is more or less a spanning tree, meaning that interdiction of a single pipe can, you know, often disrupt flow in a pretty severe way. And typically, these types of systems make great studies simply because they are so vulnerable, and it becomes quite interesting to be able to quantify just how severe these are. So this student team conducted a number of numerical exercises and considered a number of different defensive options. Initially, they were thinking that they were going to have to, in order to protect it, defend a considerable portion of sort of the backbone of this pipeline. When they did the analysis, what they learned was that by simply protecting a modest radius around key supply points in the system, they could guarantee availability for about 80% of the reserve, even when an adversary launched a worst-case attack.
So this is a tremendous contribution in terms of making the best use of your resources.
Absolutely. So it was an example of being able to quantify the return on investment for one particular defensive plan versus another. And this is a case of good news. And in fact, we were able to do quite a bit with quite a little. In other cases, we find systems that are really quite vulnerable.
And did you want to touch at all on the other two cases in that study, the U.S. Border Patrol and the electric transmission?
Well, electric transmission is a good one in general. And we've done quite a bit of modeling on electric power. My colleagues, Kevin Wood and Javier Salmerón, really are electric power experts. But as we know, energy is an increasing topic of discussion. And one of the things about electric power is that there is a long history of studying reliability theory to look at how the system will continue to function when certain components are lost. And typically, the industry standard is to look at either N-1 or N-2 reliability. That is, what happens if you lose a single component in the system, or maybe even two simultaneously. Some of the modeling that my colleagues do allow us to look at sort of an arbitrary number of components being lost simultaneously, and to be able to quantify specifically what those disruptions could look like. Now, here, the recommendations are quite interesting, because the components in the electric power infrastructure, transformers and whatnot, actually have very high reliability. They're made from materials that have a sort of normal mean time between failure of, you know, hundreds or sometimes even thousands of years, so they don't fail on their own, but they're very vulnerable to deliberate disruption. And it turned out in the course of this analysis that has been going on for quite some time that these components are very expensive, they're no longer made in the United States, and they're a long lead time to obtain replacement parts. And so by studying the vulnerability in a systematic way, it was possible to make specific recommendations about where spare parts would need to be kept, how many you would need, and there was a justification for that type of defensive spending when from purely a reliability standpoint it might not necessarily have made the cut.
So once again, in terms of use of scarce resources, you were able to zero in on the best use of dollars to protect the particular electric transmission system that you were studying.
That's correct.
By the way, I see the term red teams is used in the study in connection with exercises and modeling. What are red teams?
So red teams come from military wargaming exercises in which the U.S. is typically represented as the blue team, and the opponent is typically represented as the red team.
I see.
So a red teaming exercise, or being the red team, means playing the role of the opponent.
Different people in the federal government build different kinds of models for protecting the infrastructure. I understand that Homeland Security takes a different approach than DOD, Department of Defense. Can you contrast the different kinds of modeling?
So, yes, I'll do my best. So there are lots of techniques being used by lots of groups, so it's hard to characterize either Department of Homeland Security or Department of Defense sort of as a single entity. But what is true is that the dominant approach being used today in thinking about infrastructure and infrastructure defense is based on the notion of risk. Now, this comes from classical risk analysis for thinking about non-deliberate hazards such as natural disasters or even technological accidents. And the development of risk analysis has been a huge success over the last century. There's a very mature insurance industry in the private sector that supports this. And essentially what one does is look at the likelihood of different scenarios along with the corresponding consequences for each, and then you do sort of an expected outcome analysis that allows you to bring those things together into some notion of risk. And the objective in many cases is to act so as to reduce that risk.
Now, you were telling me about the differences between Homeland Security and Department of Defense.
Yes. So following 9/11, when we were suddenly confronted with thinking about deliberate threats from an adversary, the first thing that folks did in kind of a natural way is to take the tools and techniques from sort of classical risk analysis and try to apply them to deliberate threats. The problem has to do with how one goes about characterizing the potential behavior of an intelligent adversary using likelihoods. I'm personally not sure that it makes any sense. So in deciding when and how to attack, terrorists just don't roll dice. They are observant, they are patient, they plan, and they wait until the time is right. This is a decision problem that's being made, not a probabilistic event. And we would argue that it should be modeled as such. So what we would argue is that rather than trying to characterize the most likely outcome of some type of probabilistic event, when thinking about deliberate threats, what we should try to be doing is thinking about the worst-case outcome that an intelligent adversary could mount on any particular system.
So then, rather than using a framework that looks at the risk of a crop failing, you're looking at a model in which there are human actors who oppose you, and you're trying to model their behavior. Would that be correct?
That's right. That's absolutely correct. And so essentially what we're using is game theory.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how you use it to analyze vulnerabilities. We've talked about the electric grid or in any other systems that you're looking at.
In practice, these models that we build, which are often called attacker-defender models, are using essentially a combination of game theory and large-scale optimization. Essentially, what we're assuming is that we have a game between two opponents, an attacker and a defender, who have opposite objectives. And they play a game of successive moves in which each acts in his own self-interest, which means that they're going to do the worst they can to their opponent. Now, one of the challenges here is that for realistic scenarios, the number of actions that either the attacker or the defender can take ends up being unbelievably large. So you really can't represent the payoffs in the game in the form of a standard payoff matrix. But you can use large-scale optimization theory to find optimal combinations of attacker and defenders, attacker and defender courses of action, and that's exactly what our models try to do.
I gather that when it comes to modeling terrorist attacks, modeling is not quite as good as intelligence gathering, at least not yet. What's your take on what is called intent-based analysis, and what exactly is that?
So to me, intent-based analysis means that you're trying to represent the likely courses of action, that is the intents of the adversary, and then plan based on that. There are times when intent-based analysis is perfectly appropriate. So, for example, in law enforcement, if you get strong intelligence that a particular event is going to happen tomorrow at a particular place and time, then of course you want to use that information in your planning. But this type of analysis is most effective only when you have short time horizons and typically when there's strong intelligence. Over longer horizons, the quality of any likelihood estimate of the enemy action is going to be much worse, to the point where I'm not sure it makes sense to use it as input. In reality, who can say what the probability of an attack on a particular site is going to be over the next several years? And a real question that has been debated is how do you go about validating these types of probabilities with science?
How does capabilities-based assessment, another approach, differ, and what does it offer our national defense?
Yeah. So in contrast to intent-based analysis, we would argue in favor of something called capability-based assessment. Now here I have to make a distinction because capabilities-based assessment within the Department of Defense and the government is often used to assess one's internal capabilities. So you have some particular mission or task that you're trying to achieve, and what you're going to do is do an internal review of how well your own capabilities match up with your ability to achieve that mission. Here what I'm talking about is the ability of the adversary, so the capability of the adversary to inflict damage on you. So in capability-based assessment, what we're going to do is look at the amount of damage or disruption that an adversary can cause to a system based on some level of capability. And here we're much better at assessing what, you know, 10 guys, a truck, and some explosive could potentially do than guessing at what they're thinking about or what they've been told to do.
Ah, okay. And you can base it on things that they've done already.
Yes, that's right. So there's a lot of intelligence in capabilities, which essentially gets much more to sort of the physics of it, of explosions, of energy, of these types of things. And here, when it comes to infrastructure, on both sort of the offensive and the defensive side, it's important to keep in mind that the time scales on which we're operating are really quite large. If we're going to be pouring concrete or making sort of very long-term investment decisions, these actions that we're going to take are going to need to last us for not only for days and months, but for years and potentially decades. And so we have to be thinking about not only the adversaries that we face today, but the adversaries that we're going to face in the future. And this, again, argues against sort of trying to do intent-based analysis, because who knows what the intentions of our adversaries far distant into the future are going to be.
That's all the time we have today. We've been talking with Professor David Alderson of the Naval Postgraduate School. Professor, thank you for joining us.
Barry, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you for listening to this Science of Better podcast by INFORMS, the Institute for Operations Research in the Management Sciences. For more about operations research and the series of podcasts, visit us on the web at www.informs.org. Good day, and remember, keep on crunching those numbers.